Welcome to That'll Preach. We are here today together live, me and Paul, talking about what we love to talk about, Paul's latent communism, his just Marxist social justice, total wokeness, everything infecting his brain, all of it. So Paul, as our resident progressive liberal Marxist, how excited are you to talk about what we're about to talk about today?
The progressive Marxist who has like more conservative sexual ethics than anyone else in the non-denominational world.
It's funny because that's your dating profile, which is odd. Yep, that's right.
Got those conservative sexual ethics.
There you go. There you go.
Come and get me, ladies.
Ladies form a nice and orderly line for that. Well, now that we've lost all of our viewers, we can actually get to the...
That was so awkward.
Yeah, this was very...
I love it.
Very strange.
Let's lean into it. It's good.
You took it there.
I did. I know.
You took it there.
It's late.
Yeah. So we are recording late at night.
This is our prime time.
Just like our old days.
Yeah.
You know, back when I was a bachelor. Just recording, you know, just recording to the wee hours of the night.
Drinking our Diet Cokes.
Mm. Not a care in the world, except for COVID around us and
yes,
all that stuff. But the idea behind this podcast was an article, or rather, it was a talk that you gave at EPS, which is like Disney World for nerds.
The right? Extraterrestrial Persons Society.
EPS.
Extraterrestrial Persons Society.
Okay. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Evangelical Philosophical Society.
There you go. Evangelical Philosophical Society, which, as Paul loves to point out, is an oxymoron. I'm just kidding.
I was like, I don't recall saying that. Maybe I did.
Yeah.
It sounds like something.
Everybody
I'd
likes
say.
To trash evangelicals.
Nah, they're okay.
Yeah, I know. I'm an evangelical proudly, and I don't care what anyone thinks, except for you. But. Anyway, you gave this talk. It's very intriguing. And when you were telling me about it, I was like, oh, this would be a great thing to get the podcast on. It's the title of your talk is What Does Jesus Think About Robin Hood? Which, great clickbait.
It's amazing. That's how you do it. Yeah.
What inspired you to think about this question of what Jesus thinks about Robin Hood? And then maybe you can talk about what you're actually trying
What
to
does
prove.
Jesus actually think about Robin Hood?
Why do you care? You know Robin Hood, I don't think he was real.
Yeah.
Was he okay.
Probably not.
But regardless, take us to the beginnings of how this idea for this talk came about.
Well, the Robin Hood question was obviously just an afterthought to get a clickbaity title and get butts in the seats, which it did. It, you know, packed that room. I learned my lesson very early on that if you're going to give an academic talk, make sure you have a great title. So it was either this or the natural law argument for the Christian exhortation to the obligation to the poor. And this just sounded a lot sexier. So I just went with that. It was totally
okay.
Just vain right. Showboating.
Okay. There you go.
But there is something, I mean, it gets at the heart of the question, which is, can there be situations where it's permissible to take something from someone else when you need it yourself? So the Robin Hood trope, Robin Hood takes from the rich and gives it to the poor, takes it from the sheriff of Nottingham and gives it to the poor. And you might think that's stealing. And so if stealing is always wrong, then that's impermissible. You might think that stealing is sometimes permissible, in which case maybe he's not wrong. Or you might think that that's just not stealing at all because he's not taking what doesn't belong to him. He's taking what rightfully belongs to him and just giving it back to the poor. So, and there is a strong tradition in the Christian natural law tradition that says, actually, how we think about private property and how we think about ownership of resources should affect how we answer this question. And as I argue, I think there is a Christian line of argument that says, you can take what you need from someone else who doesn't need it in certain cases. And I know that's radical, and I'm happy to defend that, but that's just sort of the basic instinct.
You're a communist.
I'm not a communist.
Okay, no, but this, okay, so this is an interesting argument. So you're talking about basically, it's a question of ownership. Who
right.
really owns the resources? Do you think this is assuming theism, assuming that God
it is, yeah, yeah,
is
yeah.
creator of all things and
yeah.
intends it for the good of his and the flourishing of his creatures? Okay, so you have this idea of a natural law argument that Thomas Aquinas talks about.
Yeah.
And I feel like people who like are like nerds about Thomas, they always just say, he's Thomas. Aquinas is where he's
from. It's interesting. The Roman Catholics will say Thomas. Protestants say Aquinas. So if you're listening to a talk and someone says Aquinas, they're most likely Protestant. Hmm. The Catholics will say Thomas or St. Thomas.
Yeah.
There you go.
What do the Eastern Orthodox say? Tommy.
Yo, Lil Tommy.
Lil Tommy. There you go. In Gregorian chant. Just...
Lil Tommy. Hey. Well, you heard it here first, folks. Yeah. If we have any Eastern Orthodox listeners, we just like totally lost them.
Eastern Orthodox don't listen to our
podcast. That's true. They're too sophisticated.
Yeah. That's it. That's exactly it. Okay. So natural law.
Yeah.
Aquinas. Why don't you lay out the argument for us? Why is it permissible?
Yeah.
To steal from the rich.
First of all, it's not stealing. And so here's a couple cases. So imagine you are out in a snowstorm and you happen upon a cabin and it's freezing. You need shelter. You need food. Everywhere else for miles, there's just nothing but blizzard and you're going to die. If you break into the cabin, just like shelter yourself, light a fire, eat some food, are you doing anything wrong? I mean, that's just the first question there, right? Like maybe you're not. I think most people say that's permissible. You're doing something there. That's okay.
You need to survive.
Right. You have to, like, it's essential.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that in US law, you can't be prosecuted for breaking and entering in those kinds of cases. Because there's a kind of recognition of this right to self-preservation. You have a right to preserve your life. And if that cabin is the difference for you between life and death, you breaking into it is not really a case of breaking and entering. You're not really trespassing on someone else's property. So there's a sense in which the cabin has, quote, fallen into commonality. It's become common for the use of those who need it. So not just for you, there were other people too, they'd all have the same right to use it. Because they need access to it. So that intuition is really interesting. It's one that is in our, like it's reflected in how we think about the law and how we prosecute breaking and entering and how we think about the right to self-preservation. What I think is interesting is that this is not something unique to how we think about property. This is something that goes all the way back to the church fathers, but it gets its most developed articulation in Aquinas. So I can read out the passage from Aquinas here. Maybe we could talk about that or do you want
to
jump in?
But just to backtrack a little bit. So you're basically saying that even in US law, there's the understanding that you need to preserve your own life.
Yes.
And if you need to preserve your own life, that means that there are certain goods that you have a right to.
Yes.
Because that's the means through which you preserve your life. And so in that situation, you're not legally liable because that food in the shelter or that shelter, whatever, to keep you alive. It actually belongs to you.
Yes.
Even if it legally belongs to somebody else, that's yours.
Yes. There's a sense in which it falls into common property. So it, like, commonality means it anyone who has need of it could use it. So it's not that it's like absolutely yours. It would be like kind of incorrect to say it's your property in that moment. But because this other person, let's say I own the cabin.
Yeah.
I'm not using it in that moment, so I don't need it.
Okay,
so in the sense that you need it. Okay. I don't, right. I'm in my beach house in Florida, for example, right?
Right.
I'm not in this storm, so I don't need this cabin. But you need it, which is evidenced by the fact that if you don't get inside there, you're going to die.
Right. So in this scenario, it's a key detail is that you don't need it as well. So it wouldn't be like, you know, a homeless person can just break and enter into your home and stay in your house while your family's there.
Right. That would be different.
Right.
Unless it's a case of like, there's a storm and you have an extra bed or something like that. That might be different. Like there's terrorists outside or you can construct these cases, right?
Right.
But like in most of these cases, it has to be you need it and this other person doesn't need it. Like their life is not hinging on access to the cabin as well.
Right. And so, they can't harm you because then that would be
well, of course not.
Destroying
yes, of
your
course
preservation.
Not.
So we're not talking about anyone can break into someone's house if they need something. But
no,
it's a very specific case in which everyone has a right to self-preservation. And then if you don't currently need this resource, and somebody else needs it, they have a common right to it, which is different than them having a right in the common way that we think about it. But there's a category of ownership that can be brought to light in these situations.
Yes.
And we even recognize it legally.
Yes.
Okay.
Think of the Jean Valjean case from Les Mis. So he, quote unquote, steals.
Martial arts guy, Jean Valjean.
What are you talking about?
Jean-Claude Van Damme.
I don't. John Vogt. Oh, that guy. Wow. You were so. Our cultural gap is so massive here.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
I was talking about like Victor Hugo, Les Mis.
Yeah. Yeah.
He steals a loaf of bread, or quote unquote, steals a loaf of bread to feed his starving nephew and then gets sentenced to 19 years in prison.
Can I be honest? I've never read or seen Les Mis.
You should not have outed yourself.
Except for in eighth grade, our middle school, I think we went to go see the high school's production of Les Mis.
And it was probably fell terrible.
Asleep, boring. I was like, and then, but I had no idea what Les Mis was before that high school performance. And so I'm just like, what is this weird French drama? I don't even know what this is about. They're singing. And until later, I found out, oh, that was supposed to be a classic. Like the whole time, I'm like
this sucks.
Is terrible. And then I find out it's like an enduring classic work of art and literature and all that stuff. So that was a shock. People are like, have you seen Les Mis? I'm like, yeah, it was terrible. Like, oh my gosh.
I thought you were going to say, I haven't seen Les Mis until I saw the Key and Peele spoof in like 2012, which is also hilarious.
I don't know if I've seen
we should it. Put that in the show notes or something.
Yeah, there you go. Let's backtrack to what we're actually talking about.
Yeah. So Jean Valjean, quote unquote, steals a loaf of bread from the bakery to feed his starving nephew, sentenced to 19 years in prison. The intuition that's supposed to be pumped by that story is that was unjust. Like something's wrong with that society for imprisoning him for taking this bread to feed his starving nephew who's going to die. And the idea there is, well, what Aquinas would say and what the church fathers would say and what Calvin would say, I'm going to pull all these quotes out, is if God owns all of the property, God owns everything in the world. Everything belongs to God. And God gives it to us to meet our needs. Then I can never own something that for me would be an extra, but for you is the difference between life and death. Hmm. So I cannot withhold it from you if you need it. And if you need it, you can take it from me. Hmm. That's essentially the... So it does require this theistic picture of the world. It requires that God owns everything. When we own things, we only own them like stewards, or we own them derivatively. And we talked about this when we did went to Calvin's little book on the Christian life. God owns everything. We're just stewards. So like part of being a Christian and thinking about private property is to like loosen our hold on private property just a little bit. Like maybe we're thinking about private property too much, like in a libertarian lens or something like that. But actually everything belongs to God, and God gives it to us for the purpose of meeting our needs. And then if somebody else needs it and I don't, but it's currently in my possession, quote unquote, there's a sense in which that person actually has a right to it. So it I think it's actually not as radical as initially sounded.
So it would be like if you look at your personal possessions and you have extra money that you don't need,
mm-hmm.
and there are people who are starving in the world who need that money, would it be fair to say that if you gave that money, that's not generosity?
Yes. Yeah.
Because generosity, so the distinction would be, generosity would be that they don't need the money,
mm-hmm.
but you give it to them.
Yes.
Is that more virtuous?
It's
two different things.
Two different kinds of acts.
So when you're generous, you are giving to somebody something that they don't necessarily need.
Right. It's over and above.
It's over and above what they need.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So to be generous would be to give a great gift, or to, you know, pay for redecorating someone's house. I don't know, something like that.
Yeah.
But if you give somebody who needs money to live, money that's extra to you, it's not mm-hmm. going to take away from your life.
Yep.
What would you call that?
That is a requirement. It's justice.
Justice.
And Aquinas says, so there are two ways that you can give. Some are under the order of justice and some are under the order of charity.
Okay.
So, and here's where I actually want to, I'll quote from Augustine and Basil and Ambrose, and just to draw this idea here that it's not generosity when you give to the poor man what he needs to survive. Augustine says, God does not demand much of you. He asks back what he gave you, and from him you take what is enough for you. The extra possessions of rich persons are the necessities of poor persons. When you possess more than you need, you possess what belongs to others. That's in his commentary on Psalm 147. And then Basil says, is he not called a thief who strips a man of his clothes? And he who will not clothe the naked when he can, is he deserving of a different title? The bread that you keep in your possession belongs to the hungry. The cloak in your closet belongs to the naked. The shoes that you allow to rot to the barefooted, and your hoarded silver to the indigent. Hence, you have done injustice to as many as you have failed to help. So it's not generosity. It's a matter of justice. Ambrose and Calvin say the same thing. Ambrose says, you are not giving to the poor anything that is not yours, but rather restoring something that is his. And then John Calvin says in his commentary in Isaiah 58, this is the dictate of common sense, that the hungry are deprived of their just right if their hunger is not relieved. And then in his commentary in 2 Corinthians 8, he says, an equality is to be observed here, that no one is to be allowed to starve, and no one is to hoard his abundance at the expense of defrauding others. So this language of defrauding, injustice, rights, there's this sense in the Christian tradition that every human being has a right to bread, to that which they need to survive. And if you can help this person, you're not doing something generous. You're merely giving back to them what is theirs. And that's radical. Like, remember the first time I read this, I thought this was kind of crazy. Like, we just don't talk about this, but this is all there from Chrysostom all the way to Calvin.
So there's a difference between justice, I guess, would you say metaphysically, or just the objective truth of what justice is, and then what's just in a legal system.
Sure, yeah.
Or what's permissible legally.
Right.
And so for a Christian, I mean, you have sort of these two principles. You have that principle of self-preservation, mm-hmm. but then you have the principle of submission to government.
Mm-hmm.
Orders. And so should a Christian who's hungry, like let's say they make it illegal, you can mm-hmm. under no circumstances take someone else's food.
Mm-hmm.
And all the moral obligations are met. The person doesn't need the food. It's extra. You're about to die. I guess, would it be a matter of saying, I'm going to obey God and preserve my life by disobeying whatever kind of legal injunction there is?
Well, there's a couple responses you can give here. I mean, Augustine, Aquinas, the reformers all thought if a law is unjust, it's not a real law. Hmm. It has no actual authority on you. Okay. So a law that says, like even in the book of Daniel, a law that says, don't pray to the gods of Israel, yeah. pray to, you know, the statue. That's not one that you have to follow because it's not just. Sure. By nature, it is evil. Any law that says you have to turn in Jews when you find them, right? Like those laws are to be disobeyed.
It's morally incumbent upon the person to say, I will suffer the fine for this, or I will suffer whatever legal ramifications there are to give food to this person.
Oh, yeah.
Or if the person says, I'm going to, you know, I have a right, even if they're going to throw me in jail for this, I have a right to do this for myself or for my family.
Yeah. I mean, and there might be a matter of prudence, like, is going to jail worse?
Right.
Like sure. then maybe not, but like here we're assuming, and here this is, I'm being like philosophical and abstract. The principle is one that I want to defend.
Yeah.
Where and how we can apply it, that's a totally separate issue. But just
a good point.
In principle, it can be permissible to take from someone else what for them is extra, but what for you is need. And those are two very important qualifications. It has to be extra for them, and it has to be need for you. And this is why Aquinas says, in cases of need, all things are common property. So there would seem to be no sin in taking another's property, for need has made it common. And then later he says, each one is entrusted with the stewardship of his own things, so that out of them he may come to the aid of those who are in need. Nevertheless, if the need is so manifest and urgent that it is evident that the present need must be remedied by whatever means be at hand. For instance, when a person is in some imminent danger and there's no other possible remedy, then it is lawful for a man to meet his own needs by means of another man's property, taking it either openly or secretly, nor is this, properly speaking, theft or robbery. So it's not theft. So the fathers and Calvin are questioning, not saying theft is permissible sometimes. They're saying it's not theft because certain cases, the property has actually changed hands. When the storm in the cabin is there, it's not permissible breaking and entering. It's not breaking and entering. In the case of Jean Valjean, it's not permissible stealing. It's not stealing. If you have this view where God actually, like, God is the one keeping the tally for who owns what.
Right.
And God says, that person needs this bread. So actually, like, metaphysically, it transfers ownership. So you're just taking what's yours, even if it's not recognized by the law.
Right. So that's the key distinction.
That's there. The key distinction. Yeah.
Because you're not saying in some cases, so theft would be defined as taking someone else's property.
Yes. Yes.
Right. Against their will.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying, it's not as though we're saying there are some times when it's okay to take someone else's property.
Right.
You're actually rather saying that in those cases in which you need this provision mm-hmm. so that you can live,
mm-hmm.
that provision now becomes your property.
Yes.
So you're actually taking what's actually yours.
Yes.
And not only are you taking what you think is yours, God also affirms that and says that actually belongs to you, regardless of what the owner of it thinks and regardless of what the society or the government or the laws think.
Yes.
It belongs to you objectively
mm-hmm.
because you need it to survive.
Right. Which is, I mean, it's
it
a consistent
sound too
view.
Controversial.
I know.
I even think instinctively we would feel that way. I mean, if we knew about somebody, a dad who has to break in and take, you know, breaks into a mansion and takes all their extra food without harming anybody.
Yeah.
So they can feed his family of five.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody would really say that he should go to jail for that.
Right.
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 Or at least if they did, they would really have to struggle to get to that.
Right. It would be heartless. And
right.
And then there's something there, and I can almost hear like the detractor saying, well, but that data five should be working or something like that. Here we're sort of bracketing all those concerns. And what Aquinas says is that this need can only be remedied in this way. Like, this is the only bread that is accessible. He's tried right. everything else,
okay.
right? He's
yeah.
tried, there just is no more bread, but this one rich dude just takes all the bread and it's just sitting in his house and he's not eating it all, but there's this family of five that's starving.
Right.
There, Aquinas was like, that man is stealing from this because actually that's God's bread.
So
and it's God's bread
case
for this man.
That if the guy is trying to feed his family and there's a soup kitchen that's open 24/7, they're willing to give
right.
him any food. And he
yes.
said he chooses to break into someone's house.
Assuming he knows both options
sure.
are there, right. Then you can't.
And he can access
that's
both.
Right. That's
okay.
right. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
So it has to be that this has to be a last resort, which, like the cabin case, it is the last, there's literally nothing else. So it has to be that this is the only thing that can remedy the need. It has to be that it's a true case of need.
Hmm.
So like self-preservation. And it has to be that the other person doesn't need it. So if those conditions are met, that's the schema, that's the formula. Then you can take it and it's not theft. It's not robbery because it's not that person's property. So I think it actually encourages us to think about property a little bit more loose-handedly or open-handedly. And again, like that affirmation that this is everything we have is actually God's. And you got to wonder, like, when we have these really strong norms of private property, like, this is my possession. And like, when we think about like, oh, people like are trespassing, that's just they're sort of like, it's like a slight against me personally. And you think like, well, no, like everything is God's. There's a sense in which I should be a little bit more open-handed.
Sure.
Right? Like that's the instinct that we should be cultivating.
Or even if you go, I have a right to this property. Well, you have a legal right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that God does recognize personal property. I mean, you see, I mean, he gives plots of land to the tribes of
sure.
Israel. I mean,
yeah.
he recognizes
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Or rather, he actually ordains it in some circumstances. But there's a tipping point in which, yeah, if there's a homeless guy or if there's somebody, a family who, to escape, you know, a torrential downpour or to escape, you know, people chasing them with knives, or I don't know, something like that. I'm trying to think of an extreme situation.
Mm-hmm.
Then not only would it be like, not only would you be looked down upon if you didn't allow them shelter in your property, it would actually be morally wrong.
Right.
And not only that, but God would not recognize, quote unquote, your property rights in that situation
mm-hmm.
because you're depriving them of the protection and security that,
right.
that they deserve.
And there's a kind of failure to see yourself as a beneficiary of God's grace when you deprive others. So imagine you've got all this stuff and you see the person in need. And even bracketing the debate about whether or not they can come in and take what they need from you, just the attitude itself of I'm not going to give, you fail to see yourself as a beneficiary of God's grace, that you are merely a steward. That language of stewardship comes up over and over and over again in the language of the church fathers and the reformers, everything that we have, we are mere stewards of it. We've kind of lost sight of this thread that says this is the Kuiper quote, like every square inch, everything belongs to God. Literally, every piece of grass, every ounce of grain, everything belongs to God, and God gifts it to us. He doesn't owe it to us. God gifts it to us, but for what? To meet our needs. Like, human beings have needs. Our flourishing consists in sociality, in breaking bread together, in having access to certain resources. Like, that's what it is to be a human being. So God gives us resources for this instrumental purpose, to keep us alive and help us thrive. Now, when you have these disparities of, I've got tons of this and someone doesn't have what they need, I can't fall back on saying, well, this is my personal property. Like, on what grounds? What grounds? That you gathered it first, that you got to it first, that you inherited it first? That's not going to work on this theistic picture of the world where everything is God's. He's given it to you to use for what you need, but if there's extra, you have to give it away. But one thing to notice here is that Aquinas and Calvin and the fathers are not saying that all wealth disparity is bad. It's permissible that some people have more than others. What's not okay is when you have more and somebody doesn't have their basic necessities. So imagine a world where everyone's basic necessities are met, then the rich no longer have an obligation to give to the poor. Then it would be charity. It would be generosity because they'd be going over and above. But it's not a matter of justice at that point.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That is not how we view it. We think that if we give food and shelter, basic needs to people, that's charity.
Right.
But that assumes that it's not owed to them.
Right.
That actually, because God is God, he has created all the resources of the world to sustain his creatures. And if some of his creatures don't have access to those resources, then we're not properly using the created order that he has given, the creation that he's given.
Right.
For its actual purpose. So God would have a problem with it.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So it's a moral obligation
mm-hmm.
that there essentially be no people who don't have their basic needs.
Basic needs.
Now, basic needs.
There's
some variation
sure,
in that.
Sure.
But I guess at the very base level, they would have to be fed.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Be protected from the elements.
Yeah.
Right.
Food, water, shelter.
Food, water, like that's, shelter. And yeah. You know, now the interesting thing is though, like, Is it self-preservation? Is it being violated if you live in a dangerous area?
Mm.
I mean, that's kind of on the gray area because that's not necessarily an immediate threat the way that not being able to eat is.
Yeah.
But is it a right, you know, when we say, I think we have a basic right not to be killed, not
right.
to be murdered. Right.
Absolutely. Right.
But does that extend to, do you have a right to be in a atmosphere in which there's a low probability of that? Is that a right that everybody has?
I mean, I think that's going to be less clear for sure.
Yeah.
And Aquinas says the need has to be dire, manifest, and urgent. And those are, you know, that's why we look to the paradigmatic cases, like the storm, the cabin, mm-hmm. Jean Valjean with the bread.
Right.
There's going to be other cases where like, is it really? But I think if we're thinking of which tendency should we err closer to, we were talking about this the other day, there are going to be virtues that are wise in between two extremes. But in terms of erring, we can err in terms of one of two ways. We can err in terms of being more giving and more open, more open-handed, or more cautious. And I think given where we are as a culture, our instinct is already to be more cautious. So maybe if we want to cultivate the virtue and get closer to the way God actually wants us to live, is to practice more radically the open-handedness. And I think it's really hard to do. It's not easy. And I think part of the difficulty is because we've become so used to a certain extravagant lifestyle, one that would have been totally foreign, not just to the majority of humans who ever lived, but especially to, I think, like the reformers, the church fathers, like Christians for most of our existence just didn't have much. And so now that we have this concept of disposable income and leisure, and I think these are just, I mean, it's not just, I think these are empirically new phenomena that most people have this in the West. Now, I think like, all right, talk to Calvin about this. What's he going to say? Well, he says, if you have an estate and you're not using it, or you have more than what you need, then sell it and give it to the poor. Like that's straight from Calvin's mouth. So this is not, to the charge that this is communism, it's definitely not communism. This is coming straight from the, like,
it's Calvinism.
It's Calvinism.
It's not communism.
It's better than Calvinism. It's Calvinism. Straight from the horse's mouth. I don't know why we say that phrase. It's so weird. It's straight from Calvin's mouth himself. And it's not communism because it's not saying the state has to control all the resources. The workers should own the means of production. Everyone should have exactly the same. It's not saying any of that. It's not even giving a role to the state.
Right.
It's just saying in cases of dire need, one can take what they need from someone's extra, and you have an obligation to give it back because it literally belongs to them.
And communism is fundamentally atheistic.
That's
and this
right.
And this assumes theism. Yeah. This assumes God.
Right.
And then, and for this whole thing to work, it's very interesting. I'm reading Leviticus 19. It says, "When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to its edge. Neither shall you gather the gleanings after you harvest, and you shall not strip your vineyard bare. Neither shall you gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am the Lord your God."
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, although this may not exactly articulate the principle that you're talking about, you can see in the Old Testament code God's care for the poor and the sojourner in this way. He basically says, don't maximize profits on your land. Mm-hmm. But leave a little bit on the edges so that the poor and sojourner can eat from it. I think part of that is God is saying, remember whose land this is.
Right.
Remember who gave this to you. So I'm telling you, he's not saying it's optional. He's saying when you do this, you must leave a little bit extra, or rather you must not view your land as something that I'm giving to you so you can just maximize profit out of. But that because it's gifted to you, there are obligations.
Right.
If you're going to have the land, you cannot cultivate all of it.
Right.
You have to allow some of it for other people. And then in the very next verse, in verse 11, you shall not steal, you shall not deal falsely, you won't lie to one another. So he doesn't view that as stealing.
Right.
He actually views that as belonging to the sojourner and to the poor.
Yeah.
That extra grain that that belongs to them.
It's been given to them by God.
The goodness of your heart.
Right.
Maybe every once in a while, don't, you know, cultivate the edges of your land. He says, no, actually, this is a regulation for you.
It's been given to them by God.
Right.
Yeah. And I mean, if you're looking for New Testament, whoever has two tunics is to share with him who has none. Whoever has food is to do likewise. The same principle is kind of implicit there. This idea, the two tunics principle, is you only need one. So if you've got what you need, then the extra thing belongs to the person who doesn't have. And then 1 John, if anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother needy, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? Little children, let us not love in word or talk, but in deed and in truth. So God's love being manifested in the world, and evidence that we have God's love is that we, when we see the need, we meet it. If we have the superabundance, or if we have the extra, if we have the means to do so. And I think for a lot of us, we do have those means. And so the question, the practical question here is, how can I begin to apply this? And there it gets a little less clear, but I think there's some obvious ways.
Well, I think there's a skepticism, though, because you were saying in America, you know, is it better to almost be generous, you know, to a fault rather than overly cautious? I think people are worried that, you know, there's another condition that the person who needs to preserve their life, who takes from someone else who doesn't need it, that they're actually going to take that provision to preserve their life and not do something else with it or something like that.
Yeah.
And I think people are hesitant about that. They're like, where's this money going? Can I trust this nonprofit? Are these panhandler, you know, fakers, or what's going on? Like, how do I actually help?
Yeah.
And we just don't want to, like Americans, we just don't want to be suckered.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, I don't think it's necessarily bad, but that means it's going to take a little more work to figure out, okay, how do you actually, you know, use your money? So you talked a little bit about what good $100 can do. So practically, what are some ways to start to apply this?
Yeah.
With $100, what can you do?
Yeah. I mean, I'm on board with the skepticism of not everything that's labeled charity is actually good.
Sure.
There's, I mean, you can read Toxic Charity. You can read When Helping Hurts. There are great books written on how American well-intentioned or Western well-intentioned initiatives actually have done horrible damage to the developing world with charitable aid efforts, not just in making people sort of dependent or reliant, but actually like the Tom's shoes. Like,
oh, I was just thinking about Tom's.
Donating, like donations of shoes and textiles have crippled entire industries in Africa. Right. That have had huge spillover effects that ruined national economies. again, well-intentioned, but there weren't people on the ground doing R&D, understanding what communities need, studying the economics. Like, we need people doing all this stuff.
Yeah.
And so this is not a plea to like, hey, anything with the label charity, go ahead and give your money to it. But over the last couple decades, there have been these new charity watchdog think tanks that are, they assess charities, they assess these nonprofits, and they put out lists every year in terms of which is most effective and how far your dollar can go. And the methodologies are always like, maybe we don't have to support all of them. Like, there's, you know, a lot of these places are pro, you know, let's try to curb overpopulation. And so they prescribe abortions or they fund tons of contraceptives. And like, we don't want to fund that stuff, right? But there's a lot of stuff that we can do that actually is in line with Christian values. And so just some of the ones that I think are, I mean, close to my heart, but also things that I think are pretty widely attested to their efficacy. Like with $100, you can purchase 50 insecticide treated nets for malaria stricken parts of Africa, which will, for every 600 nets distributed, that's one child's life saved and 500 cases of malaria prevented. That's just $100. Like that. That's crazy that you can do that much good with, I mean, $100 for most people is, I mean, it's not nothing, for, right. Especially for those of us who are like middle, lower middle class. But again, thinking about superabundance and need, you can deworm 200 children. You can provide clean water for 70 people for one whole year. You can protect 1,000 people from iodine deficiency disorders. Use four surgeries to reverse cataracts. Fund 416 antibiotic distribution to prevent blinding trachomas, and just the list go on and on. Like these organizations are being independently evaluated, and this whole movement of high impact charity, which I mean, there are some issues with it, but they're doing some work to try to move away from like the old school, anything that's nonprofit is good.
Yeah.
And that's just not true. Like we should not, as Christians, we should be stewards. Like this is God's money. And so we want the money to be used well and not just thrown in any direction. But also, maybe we should be more okay with being suckered than with being overly stingy. And maybe we use that sometimes as an excuse to cover up our own unwillingness to give. And we just say, well, I'm really skeptical. I think we need to do some serious introspection and examining of our own heart and motives. And if you think that you might be prone to that bad motive, then maybe be okay with being suckered. Be okay with being taken advantage of, right? Mm-hmm. If someone asks you to walk with him 1 mile, go with him two. Like this is the Christian life is a call to being suckered sometimes, right? Like that's what we signed up for.
It's always one of those questions where at what point do we take seriously some of the things that Jesus says?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think it's kind of like you have all the excuses in this case, you don't do it. And then it's like, okay, but at what point do you ever apply giving your tunic
right
to the person in need?
Mm-hmm.
At what point do we love our enemies? At what point? What you could go on and go on and go on. It's like it never applies to your life.
If
the situation never comes up, it's like, well, then you're not doing something right, right?
Mm.
Now, okay. So for this maximum impact charity, what are the reservations you have? Because you said there's some issues with that.
Yeah.
And as a skeptical American, I just want to know what those issues are.
Yeah.
To let myself off the hook from having to do anything.
Right. That's always the worry. I just give you more ammo for the skepticism. I think the way that these charities cash out high impact and efficiency is always in terms of how much suffering have you minimized or how many lives have you saved? And it's wedded to this utilitarian calculus that sees human pleasure and human lives as just numbers to be maximized and human suffering to be minimized. And so, for example, a lot of these people would say, for example, don't ever pay for the surgery to save the orphan here in Tallahassee. Use that money to save 100 kids overseas.
Right.
And that's not Christianity.
Right.
Christianity doesn't say more lives always are better.
Right.
Human lives are infinitely precious, and not just infinitely, they can't even be compared with one another.
Mm-hmm.
You can't say that 100 lives are more precious than one. And the reason for that, we see in the Gospels, the good shepherd leaves the 99 for the one. He sees the one as worth risking the 99 for, in a sense, like we don't read that passage in that context. Mm-hmm. No good shepherd in their right mind leaves 99 for one.
Right.
But I think that shows the value, the way that Christianity thinks about the value of human lives. We're not just trying to simply tally and say, okay, well, this equation or this initiative will save more lives, therefore we have to put our money there. I think we should resist that. And just the Christian exhortation is to give money to people who need it and to do good and to love wherever it is. Not, I'm not going to rescue this person here because I can do more good over here. That instinct is one that we should push back on. And so all these utilitarian ways of thinking about the value of human life, that's deeply unchristian, and we shouldn't fall into those temptations. So that's the one cautionary exhortation that I would want us to come away from. This is not, hey, let's just think in terms of numbers for everything. Let's be wise stewards. So let's take some of the insights of the high impact movement, but let's not turn everything into aggregating numbers and reduce people to digits on a calculator.
Well said. Well said. Well, there you go. There you go.
So it's not that controversial. I mean, it's difficult to do, but actually, like when you think about it, it's pretty clearly, it's compelling and it's convicting.
Well, we're going to put some links in our show notes to some charities, justices, yeah. Some programs that have high impact that Paul is personally donated to and knows that they do good work. So we'll put some links to that if you want to be a part of that. And we appreciate you guys listening in. And that's a good conversation. Hopefully it gets you thinking. And, appreciate your thought on this, Paul.
For sure.
Thanks for listening to our show. If you want to access our whole archive of interviews and podcast conversations, you can go to our website, thattlepreach.io. Make sure you leave a review and subscribe to our podcast on Apple or Spotify. It helps us out a ton. Make sure you share with your friends. And if you want to partner with us, you can support us on Patreon just for $2 a month. That would be much appreciated. And we also have a YouTube channel. You can visit that. It's That'll Preach Podcast. You can check out some of our content there. And as always, you can follow us on Instagram, That'll Preach Podcast. And we'd love to see you and interact with you on that forum as well. Thank you guys for listening. Catch you guys next week.